Welcome to the Gaming Legacy Podcast, where we sit down with the legendary figures and giants of the casino industry who laid the foundation for what gaming is today. I'm Roger Gross, now the editor-at-large of Global Gaming Business, and today we welcome Jan Jones Blackhurst to the podcast. Jones Blackhurst was a seminal figure in the history of Las Vegas. She came to Vegas in 1971 after graduating from Stanford University at the behest of her father, who ran a chain of supermarkets in Los Angeles and wanted to open something similar in Las Vegas. She became the TV spokeswoman for the supermarkets and later met Fletcher Jones, who owned auto dealerships in Las Vegas. She married him, and she pitched his dealerships on television as well. In 1990, she ran for mayor and was elected as the 20th mayor of Las Vegas and the first female. She uplifted the visibility of that position to the next level. During her time in office, the Fremont Street Experience was built and opened, changing downtown Las Vegas forever. The population of Las Vegas exploded during her term, and she devoted much time to making it a livable city, paying attention to the homeless situation and LGBTQ issues. She ran for governor of Nevada two times, losing twice by narrow margins in 94 and 98. She stepped down as mayor in 1999, paving the way for the four-term reign of the Goodmans, Oscar and Carolyn, also very visible mayors. After leaving politics, Jones joined Caesars Entertainment, where she pioneered the industry's first responsible gaming practices, advocating for an ambassador model and implementing a code of commitment that set new standards for integrity. She demonstrated Caesars' commitment to diversity, inclusion, and corporate social responsibility. She operated the Caesars Foundation, managing corporate gifts and philanthropic activities totaling $66 million, highlighting the profound impact that businesses can have on a society when guided by a sense of purpose and compassion. She still serves on the board of Caesars Entertainment today. She has also focused on education her entire career. She has an elementary school named after her in Las Vegas and recently assumed the mantle of executive director of the UNLV Blackfire Leadership Initiative, a testament to her enduring commitment to nurturing leadership talent and fostering diversity in the workforce. She spoke with me at the Blackfire Institute in Las Vegas in May. Welcome to the second edition of the Gaming Legacy Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk to some of the veterans of the gaming industry and outside the gaming industry in this case, for a lot of the years. My second guest for the second episode is Jan Jones, the former mayor of Las Vegas, and now she's the executive director of the Innovation Institute at the Blackfire Institute at UNLV, and that's part of the International Gaming Institute as well, correct?
Well, it was sort of a lot.
tentacles.
A lot of institutes at UNLV.
Great. Well, thanks for coming, Jan. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, too.
You know, I think back to when you were mayor, and when I was in Atlantic City at that time, and I invited you to Atlantic City. I was involved with the chamber there, and I wanted them to show them what a real mayor was like.
I got to tell you a great story about that because I remember coming to Atlantic City for that speech. And what I realized as I was sitting in my room that I was there to talk about the gaming industry and gambling, and I didn't gamble.
Right.
So I had $20. I went downstairs. I sat at a slot machine, and for whatever reason that night, I just kept my $20 and went on for 2.5 hours. And what I realized was the core of the industry. Mm-hmm. As I started winning, pretty soon everybody around me is back slapping me,
right,
and they're excited when I win, and I'm excited, right, when they win, and how social it was.
Yeah.
You know, the integration of fun and people. And people miss that about this industry.
Yeah, I think so.
It makes people feel good. It makes them happy.
Well, I just wrote a piece about how you have to give them an experience now when they come to a casino. It can't be just gambling, you know. It's got to be an experience, whether it's entertainment or that kind of thing where you have a camaraderie at a table or a group of slot machines or something like that. I think that's what's really important. I think that's what's missing in a lot of cases.
I agree. Yeah. That's why you had so many senior women. They used to call it the blue hairs going to Atlantic City.
That's true.
Well, they're all on a bus. They're playing penny slots, and they're having a grand old time.
Right.
And isn't that better than them sitting in their house by themselves watching daytime television?
Right. A lot of people criticize that. Oh, you're senior citizen. No, they're having a great time.
They're having a good time.
Right, exactly. Great. Well, Jan, thanks for coming. I want to talk about the beginnings of your experience here in Las Vegas. So give us a little background of where you came from and how you got to Vegas.
I came to Las Vegas in 1983. I grew up in Southern California, went to Stanford University, stayed in Northern California for a decade, came back. And in 1983, I was working for my family's business, which was supermarkets, Thrifty Mart, Smart and Final. And we happened to have four stores in Las Vegas that made, which were Thrifty Marts, that made a tremendous amount of money on our 48 slot machines, but not a lot of money selling groceries. And my father said, "We're not in the business of gambling. We're in the business of groceries. I need you to go to Las Vegas and see what we need to do to differentiate our stores from what else is in the market." And I said, "I'll go for 1 year." And now, close to 40 years later, I'm still here. And in 1986, so I came to Las Vegas and did figure out how to sell groceries. But in 1986, my family sold the company. And I was then married to Fletcher Jones, Jr. And I'd been doing the marketing for Thrifty Mart. And so Ted said, "Well, why don't you do the marketing for the car dealership?" And there were no women that were selling cars. So it was sort of a differentiating point. And so I did. And I did that until 1991, when a group of women that I had worked with politically came to me and said, "Listen, there's an open mayor seat. Why don't you run?" And so I went to the three people in Nevada that make decisions on who's going to be elected in politics, who, by the way, are still the same three people who make decisions on who's going to be elected in politics. Said, "I'm thinking of running for mayor. What do you think?" They said, "Don't be ridiculous. You could never win." And I thought, really? Really? It's just marketing. It's just marketing. So I sort of ran on a dare, won in the primary, much to everybody's surprise, including my own. Woke up the day after and thought, "Oh my God, what have you done? Got to figure out how to be a mayor." But it was a while.
Well, I remember seeing you on those commercials when I first came to Vegas, and and thinking, and they were funny commercials.
They were funny.
Yeah, you had a great edge to it. So you had a real great image, I think.
I think people knew me. I have people saying, "You know, we grew up with you."
Right.
And they were pretty self-deprecating. I was making fun of myself or my brother or my father-in-law. And so people felt like they could relate to you. And I also think, you know, if you could go back and study the demographics today, that there were a whole lot of women who weren't going to necessarily tell a pollster they were going to vote for me, because 3 weeks before the election, national pollsters said I was behind by 22 points, couldn't possibly win. But they were wrong. And so I think there was a lot of silent voting. And it's interesting, you know, I always say you can't be what you can't see. There were really no women in politics, not only in Nevada, but in our, certainly not in Las Vegas. But now we have the first majority woman legislature. So a lot of women started believing, well, if you can be that, then I can be that.
Well, you know, you were such a role model. I was speaking to somebody the other day who said he went to a demonstration with you, and you were about to leave, and all these high school girls recognized you, and they came up to you, and you signed their hats or something, every one of them. And he was telling me you were such a role model for those kind of girls.
You know, I think it gives them something to look up to. Young women are not always told you can be anything you want to be. And I think you can be, but someone has to give you permission sometimes.
So, you know, again, there were no female mayors of Las Vegas until you were elected. How did they approach you? How did the casino owners?
Interesting. When I couldn't really raise a lot of money when I was running, because everybody thought I was so far and behind, and the incumbent city councilman was very popular. Who gave me money for the gamblers? Bobby Baldwin, Steve Wynn. Jack Pinion so much, Bob Stupak. Because what do gamblers do? They place a long bet. Steve was opening, had opened the Mirage. He wanted a different image for Las Vegas. He was getting ready to invest a lot of money. And he thought a woman with a Stanford degree was a better look than what we'd had in the past. And so he placed a bet. And I think when I was elected, they weren't really sure how to deal with me. But, you know, I was raised in business by my father,
right,
and I wasn't really afraid of anybody.
Yeah.
And when they see you're not afraid and you're willing to work with them and you can put yourself at the table,
sure,
then they're willing to work there.
Right. So when you were mayor, it was the downtown was not doing very well. I think 80% of the revenue, it probably still does, comes from the Strip, they were struggling.
They were really struggling in the past. Mm-hmm. 80% of the people who visited Las Vegas made one trip downtown,
right,
just to see old, yeah, Vegas, Fremont, mm-hmm, Street. When I was elected, only 20% of the people from the Strip went downtown.
Okay.
And that number was going to grow,
sure,
because the Strip was, they were beginning to blow the Strip up and build new resorts.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we had to come up with something,
mm-hmm,
that gave a reason for people to want to go downtown.
Right.
And so downtown was scary and there were, mm-hmm, a lot of homeless,
right,
and,
yep,
so people were tentative. And so, and everybody said we'd never be able to do it, but we did. We pulled together all the downtown owners, the Jeannie Hoods, the Jack Binions,
right,
the Jackie Gahn, Steve Wynn, Bill Boyd. These were big personalities.
Right.
And we had to come up with a concept that would bring people downtown. And,
right,
we looked at everything. We looked at Star Wars. We looked, mm-hmm, at Venice Canals.
Right.
And finally, Steve hired John Jurdy, who came up with Fremont Street Experience,
mm-hmm,
which was brilliant,
right,
because it created basically the world's largest casino,
mm-hmm,
in a covered, safe environment,
right,
where people could walk from casino to casino. So it didn't benefit just one. It,
sure,
benefited everybody.
You had to go outside to do it.
You had to go out to, mm-hmm, to do it. The technology,
mm-hmm,
in the 90s was really state-of-the-art.
Right.
You know, watching that screen light up. You could hold events down there. You could do ice skating rinks. You could do Christmas tree lightings. And of course, all we had to do was get it financed.
Sure.
And that's where the gamers came in.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to use eminent domain. And that's where,
right,
the city came in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can't be faint of heart if you're going to find a way,
yeah, right, yeah,
to convince, sure, people to give you their property. But they just, I think they celebrated 30 years of Fremont Street Experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's proven itself to be a phenomenal success.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, people come down there, they have to see the light. And of course, they've upgraded the canopy since,
right,
then. And it still is pretty amazing to watch that.
Yeah, it is.
So you had to raise, I think every casino gave, what, $12 million?
Yes, and then the city put in money and used, mm-hmm, powers of eminent domain. I remember Chick Heck. Do you remember our senator?
Yeah, sure.
He was one of the property owners.
Right.
You know, and you had to find a way to negotiate with,
right,
those guys.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, these guys were powerful guys.
Yeah, they were.
You know, Jackie Gahn and, you know, and Jean Hood was a powerful woman, you know.
Yeah.
I remember interviewing Jean Hood when she came to Atlantic City, running the Playboy Casino there, or the Atlantis Casino, I guess they call it in those days. But she was a great woman. And how did you really, you know, get involved with those people? How did you keep them in line? I mean, Bill Boyd as well. I mean,
it was interesting. I decided we really needed someone professional,
mm-hmm,
to run the Fremont Street Experience.
Right.
And Don Snyder, who had just come to town as president of First Interstate Bank,
right,
and had left, was the perfect pick.
Yeah.
Everybody liked him. He's,
mm-hmm,
a very calm guy. I liked working with him. And so between Don and I, we,
right,
sort of corralled big personalities with a common interest.
Sure, right.
And tried to give them the confidence that they weren't this money, they're going to get a return on their investment, because it was a big bet.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say they weren't feisty at times.
Right.
They were very feisty.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, with that group, you just can't show any fear.
Right, yeah, yeah. So you've always been interested in education. In fact, there's a elementary school in Vegas named after you now, which I think
my
is very appropriate. That's very nice. But and you know, even to this day, Nevada's education is at the bottom of the barrel when it comes to ratings in the United States. But you recognized that early on, and why was that so important to you?
You know, education is the stepping stone,
yeah,
for anybody.
Yeah.
To take control of their life.
Sure.
It's a great equalizer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but even more so today, do you know in our Clark County School District, they speak over 56 languages.
Mm-hmm.
We represent we're probably the most representative of what America looks like today.
Right.
And so when people talk about how terrible our education is, I take a little bit of umbrage because you can't compare our statistics to Des Moines, Iowa.
Right.
They don't speak 56 different languages in their school district.
Yeah.
And it's not the size of ours. You know, we need to do some things. What interested me, and it's why I ran for governor, was I thought that a mayor would have some kind of control over education.
Right.
And really, you have none.
Yeah.
Governor does all of the funding. Mm-hmm. The supplemental education, sure. Myron Levitt was an old city staffer, came from government, who explained to me how the supplemental education fund worked. And that meant they kept raising money for education and they put it in the fund, but then they dropped the increase at the bottom. So the fund never got any bigger.
Right. Yeah.
So I decided I was going to go to Carson City
right.
to change that.
So you ran for governor twice and you didn't make it either time. Why do you think you didn't win those contests?
I think the first time I made a rookie political mistake. And I think because I didn't come out of politics and I right. didn't have a political background, there really are rules.
Right.
And I was running for governor because, you know, I was very popular and I wanted to do something about education.
Right.
And honestly, when I got in the race against Bob Miller,
right.
he really was term limited. Now, the attorney general found that he wasn't, but who's the great old gaming lawyer, Grant Sawyer, when asked what he thought about the interpretation that Bob was eligible, he said it was a very interesting interpretation of the law.
Right.
So if I had known, I really didn't believe Bob was, but I shouldn't have run in a primary against a Democrat.
Right.
Just not the right time, the right thing to do. When I ran against Kenny, and I actually became one of Kenny Gwynn's biggest fan. He was a lovely man and a great governor. But Harry Reid was running against John Ensign. And there was not a strong Democrat at the top of the ticket. And if Harry didn't have someone who was going to pull out a Democratic voter who was not his profile, he was going to lose.
Right.
If you remember, he won by 435.
Very, very narrow decision for sure.
When Harry left, was getting ready to leave Washington, he called me one morning. I'm at my house in Las Vegas, and I pick up. And if you know Harry, Harry talked to you and then he just hang up. So he goes, he said, hold for Senator Reid. I'm going, okay. Harry comes on. He goes, Jan, he said, I'm just calling to thank you. My career is what it was because of you. I know you know what you did, and I know you knew exactly why you did it. Thank you. So the second time, it was as much as the opportunity. It was an open seat.
Sure, right.
But it was to make sure that the single most important elected official to Nevada, at least in its recent history, stayed in office.
Absolutely. So are you saying you didn't get a lot of help with that?
I did.
Yeah.
Not as, you know, I got a lot more help. I was just sitting there. Now, there were people who were entirely on Team Republican, but I don't think it was personal.
Well, your mayor of Las Vegas was getting support from the rural areas of Nevada and Carson City and Reno. Was that tough?
Oh, impossible.
Yeah.
And I can even ride a horse and I can ride into the rodeos, but you don't have a lot of representation.
Yeah.
It's interesting. My first term, one of the biggest solid support groups were women in Reno. They were much more organized, very, very progressive, really looking how to better the state.
Right.
But generally, you know, Reno and the rurals, first of all, they don't like Southern Nevada. They don't particularly, they don't dislike women, but they're not going to trust a woman, and they really don't like Democrats.
Okay, great. So after you left Caesars, after you left the mayor's office, you joined Caesars Entertainment.
Well, it's interesting. I had decided I wasn't going to run again because I didn't get into politics to have a title.
Yeah.
I don't need a title.
I guess you just got fed up.
Las Vegas, we had done, I had master planned with Matt Callister
yeah.
all of the east side of Fremont Street and the Las Vegas Strip. We totally master planned all of Union Pacific, which is the last piece of land I transferred to the city was for the Smith Center. That's where it sits today. So this had all been the reason the county building is down there. The county was going to move to Summerlin. And so I went to Union Pacific and said, your value in this land is me planning it, zoning it, giving you the entitlements. And I'll do that. But in return, I want 5 acres of land and I wanted it at a fair price. So they did. And I came back and I held a press conference and told the county I'd give them the land for a dollar. Because they couldn't say no. They couldn't move out and I'm giving them free land. So that was the anchor. So a lot of the things that really mattered to me, I'd done.
I see.
And I couldn't do education because the education is a governor's job or a superintendent's job. So I was sort of working with the convention authority. And Phil Satry, who was a classmate of mine at Stanford, had just relocated with Harrah's to Las Vegas from
Memphis.
That's right, because they were Holiday Inn.
Right.
And he called me and he said, you know, I'm hiring this new position. He said it's going to be head of all communications, head of all government relations, and head of all corporate social responsibility. Would you be interested? And I thought, well, that's sort of what I'd been doing, communicating corporate social responsibility and government. And I said, yeah. And it turned out to be one of the best jobs and careers I could ever imagine. You know, I traveled all over the country and the world explaining to people what integrated resorts were. And like we talked at the beginning, why gaming is really something that's great for communities. It brings people together. It starts economic development and investment. It creates jobs. It has entertainment. And people forget. Everybody thinks that the gaming industry is, oh, you're just going to be a craps dealer or a card dealer or a cocktail waitress. There are probably 150 different careers inside these buildings, from engineers to techs to cybersecurity to horticulture specialists to sous chefs and chefs. And I mean, it goes on and on and on. So it's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, no question. And you did a great job. So you just expanded into many jurisdictions after you visited there. And just recently there in Danville, Virginia.
Came back from Danville, Virginia.
I understand that it's a huge success down there.
Well, you know, people like gaming entertainment. And there was nothing in that area. So you're right on the border of North Carolina and Virginia. A 3-hour drive from South Carolina where there's no product. And so people just love it.
No question. So I think more importantly, though, you really started some of the CSR stuff, the code of commitment that you developed for Caesars, which I think really brought integrity to the game. Explain why you thought that was important.
You know, it was the first project I took when I went with Caesars. So it's 1999, and we're looking for something that would make Caesars, well, then it was Harrah's, defining. So they had started the first sort of responsible gaming initiative, which, you know, they had no voting, no gaming under 21, and, you know, don't vote, don't gamble. And I thought, what if you came up with a campaign that really talked to people about what a responsible company you are. And so it became the code of commitment to our customers to be responsible, to our employees to offer fair jobs with growth potential, and to our communities to give back. Because we were doing it anyway, but nobody was telling the story. Well, when I first came up with it, the lawyer said, we can't do that. He said, why not? And they said, well, we can't tell people we have, you know, best paying jobs and growth potential. I said, why not? They said, because we don't know if we do. I said, then we have a problem. So let's make it true. And I finally got over those hurdles. And then the gaming industry, boy, they really didn't want to do that. They said, oh, you're going to hold all of us to a higher standard. And I said, you know what? You don't want to do it, don't do it.
Right.
We're going to do it because I think it's the right thing to do.
Right.
And gaming's getting bigger. Let's stand up and look like we stand for something mm-hmm. and mean it. And so pretty soon, the AGA got a code of commitment.
Right.
And then it started growing in companies, and they started competing with each other for who was the most philanthropic.
Absolutely, yeah.
But particularly as you're going into new jurisdictions, you're going, oh, it's really.
Well, at Caesars, you were lucky to have Phil Satre in charge at
Absolutely.
That time, because he was, I know he was totally behind that.
1,000%. Mm-hmm. That's everything Phil believed in.
And when I talked to Frank Fahrenkopf, who he's a member of the Caesars board with
yes.
you, I know, and Frank was head of the AGA at the time, and he told me the best thing he ever did at the AGA was to start the National Center for Responsible Gambling.
It was.
Which was... you know, which was, you know, something that nobody ever thought of before. He told me he didn't want us to become the next tobacco industry and go before Congress and talk about how bad our product
is. You know, what's interesting, one of the things you learn in politics is to define yourself before someone else has defined you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we learned with Code of Commitment in the gaming industry and the Center for Responsible Gaming. Get ahead of it.
Yeah.
Tell your story so someone else isn't trying to
right.
define who you are mm-hmm. when it's not correct.
Yeah. You've got to be proactive rather than be reactive.
That's
at
right.
that point. Yeah. And I think Frank understood that.
He did.
So, you know, we were talking about some of the women that helped, that you held as role models. I think Jean Hood, certainly we mentioned her, Margaret Ilardi. I know she was somebody
Margaret.
Who was,
she was.
Claudine Williams, Patty Becker, you know, I mean, these
Elaine Wynn
for sure. Yeah. You know, got a rest of soul, you know, and these people were really important to the industry. And you've been pushing this agenda for your entire career. Do you think we're where we need to be with the role of women in gaming?
No, we're not where we need to be with the role in women in gaming until you have equal representation of men and women in senior executive mm-hmm. positions. And the very fact that we don't do it is really foolish.
Yeah.
So 80% of slot customers, who are they? Women.
Right.
Sports bettors. There's no shortage of sports bettors,
right.
but there's a lot of women who would really like to bet sports.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got men designing all the games
right.
and men designing all the machines, don't you think you're missing an opportunity? Even in room design,
sure.
nothing worse than going into a room, walking into a bathroom, and the lights don't work.
Right.
I can't even see myself.
Mm.
it's just bad business.
Mm-hmm.
To think that not having representation at senior management levels through all verticals of the company
right.
is a smart way to do smart business. Right. It's just not.
So the organizations like Global Gaming Women, I know you were there at the beginning of that. Is that something that's really important, I think?
I think it's a good networking group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think networking groups are really, really important.
Right.
I think we need more advocacy groups. And I think the women's groups need to align together.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about gaming women
right.
or engineering women, or everybody's got a different program.
Right.
I was just in a meeting before this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've long been looking to build a platform
right.
where on one side I've vetted all of the women, and not just gaming, but
sure.
women who
right.
are, if you're looking for engineers, tech support,
right.
gaming executives, I've got them all. I know their resumes, they're mm-hmm. vetted, they're sorted so an employer can come in and easily access what they're looking for. But on the other side, I've rated these companies.
Mm-hmm.
What are your policies?
Right.
Do you have equal pay? Do you have child care? What is your family leave policies?
Right.
And then I can say to women, you know what? All these companies want you. These two are the best employers.
Right.
And you know what? If you start doing that, everyone will raise their standards.
Right. So you would like to see companies kind of work together to do that. I mean, this is a problem I have with the responsible gaming programs these days. I mean, every company certainly has a program, but they're not the same. They're all kind of different. Do you think there should be a blending of knowledge base here?
Yes. And the reason is, when everybody's doing something separate,
mm-hmm.
governments, and this is the value of having come from government.
Right.
When someone in government sees a problem
mm-hmm.
and they want to fix it for their constituents, they're going to do what I call sound good legislation.
Right.
That means you can get some very bad public policy that is very negative to the gaming industry around responsible gaming, which is really anti-gaming, not responsible gaming.
Right.
And they're going to put it in place and you're going to be stuck with it because you didn't get ahead of it right. and say, here's the science. No. Go back to what Frank said. Here's what they're studying at the National Center for Responsible Gaming. Here's what really works in helping disordered gamblers. And we're all going to do it
right.
because we know how to do it and we know how to do it right. So you, Mr. Senator or legislature, don't have to come up with, like, who was it, Blumenthal,
right.
who was going to, all of a sudden, the feds are going to take this right. over. Yeah. Everybody should be terrified.
Yeah.
If the feds are going to start doing policy and taxation and legislation around the gaming industry.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I've always warned the AGA, for example, like they want to go to the attorney general and beg them to stop the illegal gambling. Well, yeah, well, what's illegal these days? You know, I mean, there's a predictions market illegal.
Yeah, exactly. Look, everybody says it's right. very legal. I right. talked to someone who was at a meeting in New York last week where Robinhood raised $70 million.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
now, you know.
Yeah. Just for doing what we could
do. But you see, we were our own worst enemy on sports betting.
Yeah.
Because I hate to pick on the fantasy sports guys, right. but they were all over the place. Mm-hmm. We had $20 million. No, that's not gambling.
Right. Yeah.
you know, do this, do yeah. that. Then everybody ran into universities. And all of a sudden, it created a real problem for the industry.
Right.
Because when regulators start looking mm-hmm. and legislators start getting calls from constituents saying, why aren't you controlling this?
Yeah.
You're going to create a real problem. Mm-hmm. And their solution is probably not going to be in the best interest of the industry. Because quite frankly, we are a very responsible industry generally.
Yeah.
Like, we're highly regulated. Mm-hmm. We're serious about our business. We care about our customers and our employees. And not all businesses do that. And yet people presume that they need to do more to regulate.
Yeah.
But that's, again, define yourself before someone defines you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have one little nit to pick there when it comes to we love our employees and our guests is that, but you still allow smoking.
You know what? I tried to pass legislation in Washington, D.C., actually had a sponsor. Mm-hmm. that would have outlawed smoking on any casino, both tribal and commercial.
Right.
And the smoke anti-smoking people didn't want it.
Really?
They wanted it done state to state.
Yeah.
And the real problem is it's the competitive disadvantage. If everybody would do it.
Yeah.
But when you can't regulate the tribes.
Right.
It,
yeah, you can't regulate the tribes. That's, right. that's the issue for sure. So you're here. We're here at the Blackfire Institute at UNLV, and I think UNLV's done a great job, you know, in gaming education. I know your friend and mine, Shannon Bybee, started the International Gaming Institute, a great casino executive who really knew the importance of education. Do you think that education in the gaming business has progressed where it needs to be, or do other colleges need to get involved in more of this?
You know what I think's interesting about that, Roger, is, and you said it earlier, I think that the Gaming Institute does a really good job looking at regulatory mm-hmm. bodies and how to sort of standardize
right.
regulatory law and looking at responsible gaming. But I wish that the other organizations were all coming together to standardize the practice
right.
rather than everybody doing it in their own little pockets.
Right, yeah.
And I think the hospitality school at UNLV is arguably the best in the country.
Yeah,
I mean, I think we woke up Cornell when they started seeing who was graduating
right.
coming out of that school.
Yeah.
So I would just like to see these different institutes mm-hmm. collaborate more.
Yeah. Yeah, no question. There's quite a few of them across the country now, but again, they're all in their own little silos.
That's right.
Great, great, great. Well, Jan, it's great to talk to you. You know, I hope we touched on some stuff that people will you know, enjoy your wisdom and take it to heart because, you know, you've been through a lot, and I think your view of the industry is really appropriate at this point.
I think the industry has its best days to come if they get smart.
Yeah.
And they really start thinking how they're perceived mm-hmm. and start working together
yeah.
to change that.
No question. Well, thanks for joining us on the Gaming Legacy Podcast, and thanks for watching.